Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, John Curry. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1300, we bring you a special Earth Day program featuring three new stories by Life Rattle writers Alexander Geddes, Robert Jones, and myself, John Curry. Today is the second program in a two-part Earth Day series this month. While art, as a response to environment, is no new thing, the writing you will hear carries freshness and subtlety, just what we need in learning to look anew at ourselves as visitors on and stewards of this planet. Our first writer tonight, Alexander Geddes, grew up next to a field in Caledon, Ontario. Born in Toronto in 1992, Alex is a sixth-generation Canadian, with her ancestors arriving in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, over 150 years ago. Alex decided to practice writing at a young age. At the age of four, she sold her first picture book to neighbors. She has since furthered her writing career, publishing pieces in several different books and magazines. Alex now focuses her research on the global economy and financial journalism. Alexander Geddes' story brings us to a moment when her father has just returned from Florida with boxes of artifacts. The observing, restrained narrator she paints wonderfully captures the exchange around these items, no doubt a memorable one. Let's listen now to Dinosaur Bones, written and read by Alexander Geddes.
Dinosaur Bones by Alexander Geddes. On January 19, 2007, the federal prison camp in Pensacola, Florida, incarcerated creationist Kent Hovind, found guilty of failure to submit taxes and improper renunciation of citizenship, the Supreme Court sentenced him to 10 years in prison and fines of $1.5 million. Hovind claims his incarceration was unlawful and that the state used the law to quiet his vocal creationist beliefs. On May 3, 2007, my father, David Geddes, leaved for Pensacola, Florida. He returns on August 12. "You should see it," my father exclaims, pulling another heavy cardboard box out of the U-Haul parked in our driveway. "The scenery is beautiful. It's always warm. The birds are more colorful. There were lizards, Alex, real lizards." He places the box on the ground next to six others and reaches in for another. Identical cardboard boxes, no markings, taped at the top, fill the truck. I spent a lot of time with Dr. Hovind. I refrained from pointing out that his beloved Kent Hovind never had or would be a doctor. "He's doing well. He's aged since you last saw him. Prison isn't doing him much good." My father usually lives as a quiet, reserved man of the church. Today, he grows excited talking about Hovind. I shivered. The afternoon breeze, cool for August, made me wish I'd brought a sweater. "Has he?" I ask politely. "Oh, yes. He looks like 65, but he's only 54. I can't believe what they've done to him. The men of science. Ha! They're Pharisees. This is just like the persecution of Jesus. They want to ignore and destroy the men of God." I stare at him. He stops pulling out boxes and rips the tape off of the top one. "Want to see what's inside?" Before I have the chance to answer, he swiftly reaches in and pulls out what looks like a banana. He clutches it in his hand, holding it so tightly his knuckles whiten. He gazes at it. I silently compare him to Gollum. After staring for a few moments, he thrusts the object toward my chest. "Take it. Look at it. Isn't it amazing?" I pull the thing out of his clutch and inspect it. Long and banana-shaped, the color of faded yellow paint, crusted with dirt and some brown substance. I find a small area that looks somewhat cleaner and brush the tip of my finger across it. It feels like plastic. "What is it?" "A real T-Rex tooth," my father grasps out and steals the object away. Dr. Hovind gave it to me. It's part of his collection. He gave me a lot. It's all in the boxes. He tears the tape off four boxes, leaving only one unopened. I peer down and see that each box is filled to the brim with similar faded yellow and brown objects. Look at all the bones! All the proof! My father's eyes shine. His body shakes. Let's see those so-called scientists argue with this. I ask the only question I can think of. What? These bones, they come from dinosaurs. Dr. Hovind dated them all to at less than 8,000 years old. This, right here, disproves evolution. I stare at the man as he rifles through the boxes, occasionally pulling out a bone and looking up at me with an unnerving smile and yelling, "This could be it." I rock back and forth on my heels, my hands shoved firmly into my denim pockets. "Dad, shouldn't these be in a museum?" I ask. "Not yet. They're too scientific. They'd ruin them. They won't let the people know the truth. No, we're hiding them here for Dr. Hovind until he's released. Then we'll make them public and show the world the proof of God." My eyes graze over each box, examining the proof my father smuggled across the Canada-US border. For the past 2 years, I've neglected to tell him about my atheistic beliefs. "What about that box?" I say, pointing to the last one, the one that remains unopened. My father's eyes reach the box. "Those are Dr. Hovind's tax papers. I'm taking care of them for a while. He needs them safe for his appeal. He's planning to do an appeal, you know." "Oh," I say, "isn't this illegal?" "Well, yes and no. It's not illegal to have them. We're just keeping them safe for God's warrior. This is what the Lord wants us to do. It's the right thing." His eyes track the ground as he speaks. "Please bring the evidence into the garage." He says nothing more as I, instead, pick up the unopened box and carry it into the cellar.
That was Dinosaur Bones, written and read by Alexandra Geddes. Robert Jones, tonight's second writer, was born in Mississauga's Credit Valley Hospital on the 30th of June, 1993. He's a Canadian of primarily Welsh ancestry. Robert is interested in politics, government, and law, and aspires to become a legal professional. Robert enjoys chess, photography, and Texas Hold'em poker. Robert Jones takes us with him and his pals on a secret visit to his family cottage, bringing us there with all senses. The piece takes a turn, the morning after, to a place many of us have felt, a special place, where beauty and companionship can renew us. Let's listen now as Robert Jones reads his story, Somewhere Special.
Somewhere Special by Robert Jones. A dark orange sunset lines the sky as the five of us speed by skinny, green pine trees. I roll down the window of Mike's light blue Acura to breathe in the fresh country air, a welcome change from our collective body odors. I exhale deeply and turn to my friends. "This swamp will be replaced by beaches in a few moments, guys." Trevor laughs sarcastically and wipes his neck with his sharp red polo shirt. Mike has been driving for nearly 8 hours. We turn the corner and cross a rickety wooden trail that had long ago faded in the sun. Crickets chirp as I catch sight of a familiar sign.
"Stop the car, Mike," I order.
575 River Road, the Jones Cottage. "About damn time," Dan gripes from the back seat, squished between Joey and Trevor. Mike slips his silver gear shift into park.
"You guys wait here while I make sure the coast is clear."
I gently close the passenger door behind me and tiptoe over to the edge of the property. Pine cones crunch beneath my black sneakers. Block letters on the flimsy metal gate closing off the driveway spell Jones. The gate's bottom scrapes a bed of dead pine needles. I unhook the rusty latch, swing the gate forward, and detect no other vehicles. I clench my fists, smile, and jump. I dash out to the road and signal Mike forward. Mike pulls into the rocky driveway. I run beside him, slapping the roof. Joey pumps his fist. Mike's tires crush the rough gravel, creating a familiar tune, the "We're here" sound. Mike parks the car and joins me in the driveway. Joey, Trevor, and Dan emerge from the back seat and stretch their legs. I swat my neck hard. First mosquito. Dan fans himself with his sweat-laden muscle shirt.
So, what do you think of the place, guys?
You better be able to get us inside, RJ, Joey says.
I chuckle and glance at the sky far above the newly stained deck. The remains of the sun cast a majestic orange reflection on the Ottawa River. I lay flat on my stomach and crawl beneath the deck. I feel the cool sand rub against my navy t-shirt. I squirm in deeper and notice a deflated volleyball my sister and I used to play with. Pine needles prick my belly. Trevor jumps on the deck above and showers me in dirt and cobwebs. Mike roars in laughter. Where did Dad show me? I think to myself. When I was 9, my dad showed me where to find extra keys in case of an emergency. I remember being locked out in the rain, and I hurried towards the water heater to retrieve the spare keys. I'm sure this isn't what Dad had in mind. I emerge from under the deck and jingle the keys at Mike. I head over to the brown door decorated with a green and black rooster, insert the key, turn the knob, and hear its delightful click. We'll start unloading the car. Mike heads back to the car. Trevor and Dan follow his lead. I open the door and step inside to the kitchen, with its familiar glossy white tile floor, emerald cabinets, and the rattle and hum of a tall orange 1970s fridge. Trevor enters the cottage with a 24 of Alexander Keefe's and sets it by the fridge. Mike enters with a 24 of Corona and sets it on top of the Keefe's. Dan enters with a 24 of Budweiser and sets it on top of the Corona.
That should be enough unpacking for tonight, guys, I laugh excitedly.
I guide my friends into the single-story cottage, through the dining room with its large, glossy picnic bench and antiquated oil lamps, and into the living room with its two burgundy armchairs and long green sofa. Trevor and Dan seat themselves in the armchairs. Joey and Mike plunk on the sofa in front of the stone fireplace. A JVC stereo system rests on the black mantel. I gaze at the Jones coat of arms hanging above the fireplace.
Only one thing left to do now, boys, shouts Dan as he loads the beer into the old rattler.
Mike passes me a Keefe's. I pop AC/DC's Back in Black CD into the stereo and crank it. Thunderstruck echoes through the cottage. Dan breaks into a hilarious air guitar solo as I drain my bottle.
Another one for the host, shouts Joey.
Trevor rushes over and grabs me a fresh Keefe's. We dance around the living room, pounding beers.
Yeah, it's all right. We're doing fine. You've been thunderstruck,
we sing in unison, rhythmically banging our bottles. The beer and the music continue to flow. Highway to Hell fills the cottage next. I finish my fourth beer and reach for my fifth.
Hey, RJ, thanks a lot for bringing us up here. You're a great guy, says Joey as he pats me on the back. Thank Mike for driving us up here. Without him, we'd be bored in Oakville, I say. I can't believe you snuck us up all here. Your dad would flip shit if he found out, says Trevor. He thinks we rented a cottage on Wasaic Beach, I say, and take another sip. Mike struggles to open a creaky window. It's always been my dream to share this cottage with my friends, I say with a deep smile. Back in Black comes on and I crank the speakers to full blast. I chug my beer and my friends laugh and cheer. Mike pops open a Corona and passes it to me. I tip my head back and pour it down my throat as I jig my feet back and forth. Joey roars in laughter. I bet you can't handle one more, RJ, says Dan as he hands me a Keefe's. I pound it in record time and slap the mantle. Thump. I wake up face down. My forehead presses against cold kitchen tiles. I shiver, drenched in sweat. Morning birds chirp. I struggle to my feet and stumble. My throat is cracked and dry. My head swirls. Empty beer bottles fill the kitchen counter. Cigarette butts soak in the bottles. I gaze at the rooster clock. 5:37 a.m. The sun is just rising. Perfect time for a canoe. Trevor stretches out on the green couch with his arm hanging off the side and his feet hanging off the end. Joey found his way to the master bedroom, Mike and Dan to the bunk beds. I turn the tap on the kitchen sink, splash water on my face, and drink greedily from my hands. I burp and stomach acid burns the back of my throat. I step outside onto the dew-covered deck and gaze at the beach. The red Coleman canoe rests upside down near the shoreline. The air feels like a soft, freshly laundered shirt. A train roars from across the Ottawa River. I reach under the deck and retrieve a large, smooth paddle. I walk towards the river, whittling my toes in the cool sand. As I approach the shoreline, a flock of seagulls shoot into the air. Whoosh! They rapidly beat their wings and soar as one. I flip the red canoe over and heave it into the water. 1, 2, 3, I'm off. The river is as gentle as a sleeping baby. I stroke, breathe deeply, and exhale softly. The canoe glides effortlessly through the water, and dragonflies hum along the surface. As I paddle, I reminisce. Countless family vacations, smoky barbecues, campouts, and laughter. I grin. I think of my grandma, Janet Jones, whose father built our cottage. 2 years ago, my father and I took the motorboat out and spread her ashes near Snake Island. I glimpse at the lone wooden cabinet on the island and tear up. Water splashes the back of my neck as I paddle back to shore. I drag the red canoe ashore and flip it over. The smell of bacon catches my nose as I head up the beach towards the cottage. I open the door and find Mike flipping eggs. Grease splatters softly. Morning, Mike, I say as I pour myself a mug of coffee. Joey and Dan sit at the picnic table while Trevor snores loudly on the couch. Well, what's the plan for today, Mr. Jones? Asks Mike. I take a hearty sip, pause, and think. To relive my childhood. Joey raises his mug and smiles. Don't worry, RJ. We're going to make this one to remember.
That was Somewhere Special, written and read by Robert Jones. If a theme of renewal and new perspective comes out of writing with the planet in mind, then What I've gleaned from the Earth Day theme is to look for what it is that renews you. Time with family, time with friends, time in nature, time crafting words, and remember that spring is the time when all around us this is happening. Our final story tonight is a story I wrote. In my piece, meet a father, a son, and a rare moment of awe after the sun has set. Let's listen now to Stars and Dad, written and read by myself, John Curry. Stars and Dad, John Curry. My God, John, it's the Milky Way. I haven't seen this since God knows when. Quite a view, eh? Just a sec, Dad. I have an idea. Let's get the long cushions from the recliners and lay them down on the dock. Hey, that's a great idea, John. Let's go do it. The two of us trudge back up to the little cottage on the hill. Nothing fancy. It belongs to the parents of a good friend from work, who lets me stay for cheap. And for 10 years now, I've enjoyed the summertime quietness of the small bay on Horseshoe Lake, near the town of Arden, Ontario, an hour north of Kingston. Wow, John, this is great. Just look at it stretching across the sky. That's the edge of our galaxy. The milk of it strikes me, the milk. How the sprinkling swath of fiber optics tricks my eyes and messes the points into one dazzling brushstroke, liquid almost, dripping almost, eyes to twinkling sky. What is it exactly, Dad? Our galaxy. Well, Dad begins. His voice relaxes me. Our backs on the floating dock, our arms at our sides, we sip the evening air. Our galaxy is a spiral. Earth is on the outer edge. We're looking at it flat, like a pancake. Okay, so the whiteness is all stars, that's right, and some are galaxies. And some are planets, too, I think. And some are planets, that's right. A breeze touches our cheeks. From the lake sounds a faraway sploosh, then tiny ripples. It's astonishing. It is, says Dad. Billions of them out there, so densely packed. And billions of galaxies, too. Galaxies, wow, such enormity. So vast. It's quite something, eh? And the light we see is from the past. The light from some of these stars has taken thousands of years to reach our eyes. The night sky is a good example, a good reminder that things are not as they appear. Yes. Oh, look, John, a shooting star. Woo! My pitch rises. Beaut! We're just at the right time being up here at the cottage, Dad. I read that there's a meteor shower going on. I think it's starting soon. Yeah, that's right. I think it goes on every time this year in late August. We're lucky to see this. Quite a lot going on in the water, too. That splash was a big one. Could be a frog jumping from the lilies. Yes. Or a fish. Or a fish. It's a whole new world at night. It's so calming. I can feel myself healing. Ah, good, John. You know, I think this is as good as it gets. My eyelids touch. Good old Horseshoe Lake near Parry Sound, good old Uncle Terry's cottage in the 1970s. Passing the Trust Bridge on the drive up north, over Moon River, conducted by Aunt Joanne, we'd start singing, Moon River, built by loggers. The thick round walls and ceiling beams over the main room housed a dining room table, a tattered sofa, along with an out-of-tune black piano. One summer's end, I left my huge book of gnomes on top. The first trip up the next year, I couldn't wait to see if it was still there. Oh, Dad, did you see that one? A comet streaks by. This must be the first time I've ever brought Dad up here, to the new Horseshoe Lake. Yeah, I just happened to be looking in the right place. That was a long one, John, long and bright. You know, it's amazing. Those meteors are, on average, tiny, tiny pieces of rock, no larger than your thumb. Yet they're so high up. Yes, and they burn so brightly, and they travel at tremendous speeds. Yeah, Dad, the night sky is filled with action, Well, and it's happening all day long, too. We just can't see it. Wow, Dad, just think, all this beauty, all day long, hiding behind the sun and the clouds. That's right, John. It doesn't all just stop. There's little bits of meteor dust falling all the time. Probably part of what you see on your dresser is meteor dust. So vast, so utterly vast, and everything is connected. For me, Dad, that's what's key. That's so true, John. There's so much we don't know. Life is beautiful, Dad. It is, John. Through closed eyes, I see the carpenter ants once, and the termites another time, critters that infested Uncle Terry's. I can see that porcupine on the path in the dark lit by Dad's beam, and the time late one Friday when the motorboat sputtered out of gas. Terry and Dad guffawed as the two of them paddled in the dark, Dad with a canoe paddle, Terry with a brown fuzz-covered board from the boat itself, a seat cover, dipping in the lake water. Terry cracking jokes the whole time, the most rib-tickling of all, about the real possibility of a blind, careening boat not seeing us. The guys gave me the job of torch holder and shiner to the water around us, ripples in my rays as the boat crept along. Oh, John, did you hear that? That sounded like the fish announcing their presence again. It's a whole other world down there, too. It is, John. My God, this sky. Billions and billions of points of light. Too many to count. And the technology has come so far. Now they can track all the stars. And we're learning so much, so fast. Did you realize, John, that we're moving in so many directions at once? Is that right, Dad? Yeah, well, at the equator, the Earth is spinning at around 1,000 miles an hour. If you stood on the north or south poles, you wouldn't be spinning at the same speed. But gravity would still work, that's right. Second, the Earth is moving around the sun. That's what Copernicus, who proved it. By immense calculation, yes, says Dad, and up against harsh resistance from the Church, he could have been executed, or at least put in jail for a long time for publishing his theory. Science has had to make headway with the all-powerful Church for us to know what we know now. That's so true. And our galaxy is moving too, John, and the other galaxies are moving away from each other. Some of the galaxies stay in clusters, others in superclusters. And recently, just recently, the last 2 years or so, they found that the speed in which the universe is expanding is actually accelerating. Wow, Dad, Einstein, as I recall, said the greatest blunder of his career was fudging his equations. He found that the universe was expanding and changed them before publishing, because I believe it was just too overwhelming. Then years later, Hubble took Einstein to his telescope and let him see through it the universe expanding. Yes, we've learned so much, so such groundbreaking knowledge in the past 100, even 50, 5, or even 10 years. But you know, there's so much we don't know. There's so much mystery. I suppose that's what keeps the scientists probing. I think we need to realize that mystery, Dad. More often we step back and say that. There's so much we don't know and so much we have to be thankful for. I agree. John, wouldn't it be nice to snap your fingers now? Go to a place like this when you're having a stressful day? Man, it certainly would. Listen, there's the loon. Oh, beautiful. Sounds like it's coming from down the way. I notice the sound of our breathing, side by side, breathing. Slow breaths in, slow breaths out, with our eyes leaning against the sky. Terry's sense of humor, his Muppet laugh, the time he gutted a fish and removed the still beating heart and dunked it in a jar of salted lake water on the dock. Hours later, after an afternoon fishing, Terry, Dad, and I in the small boat in a remote bay, waiting for nibbles, catching a catfish, and taking turns farting and farting. Upon returning, when Terry slowed the boat at the dock, he pointed to the mason jar with the red heart in it. The thing still beating, he giggled, practically quacking. I have a question for you, Dad. What is the universe exactly? Well, there's an outer limit to our universe where the last galaxy, the galaxy furthest out, reaches. I thought the universe meant everything. Well, if it were that way, then nothing could move. I think I'm starting to get it. I'll try to explain it in the way I read about it, John, in terms that I can understand it. You can think of the universe as a balloon that was once tiny, tiny, and is now expanding. So there could be other universes out there. That's one theory. Another is parallel universes. Our universe could be one tiny drop in a whole other system. It could. It's anyone's guess. So that's why I bet so much science fiction deals with spacecraft traveling vast distances. There is that dream of going there to the edge to see for yourself. That's right, John. The nearest star after the sun is four light years away. That's 8 years minimum, traveling at the speed of light for a return journey. If you wanted to go farther, it would take you so long you'd come back and generations will have come and gone since you left. It's almost unthinkable. And you may return to who knows what. The human race may have destroyed itself. At Horseshoe Lake's edge, where the cottage stood, lightning cracked and lit. Then thunder crashed and shook and echoed. Curled in my parents' bed at the cottage, eyes clenched, my hands over my ears, my mother's arms curled around me through each deafening blast. Eruptions, strong enough in me to picture deep, deep crevices in the earth. It's interesting, I say to Dad, that the speed of light is a constant, that no matter how much you wanted to go faster, you couldn't. That's right, John. I wonder what's beyond the outer limits. Well, again, I'll try to put it in terms I understand, and this gets even more complicated. Beyond the universe, it's as if time and space don't exist. Beyond the skin of the balloon, you could say. And there's even more to it. Our universe, by expanding, is actually creating time and space. Wow. Wow. Creativity keeps us alive, you could say, eh? Creativity keeps us alive. It would certainly seem so, eh, John? That's amazing. Amazing. And two, there's a few theories about how the universe will end. Well, we know life on Earth will end, Dad. The sun will envelop us. That's right. But not for billions and billions of years. One theory is that the universe will reach a point of expanding and then will shrink in on itself. I think they call that one the Great Crunch. Another, the more popular now, I think, is that the universe will continue to expand until everything dies out. And then, who knows what'll happen? Maybe another universe will start. Maybe. Wow. Can everything die out? Yes. All stars burn out eventually. The photograph of me catching my first fish, a pint-sized rock bass that twisted and flailed on the end of my rod, and the time my nurse, Aunt Joanne, mummified me on the sun-drenched dock as my mother reclined and read her book. Me, I stood there, shoulder to toe in gauze bandages. And there was the time I asked the adults about skinny dipping, that thing that took place after I lay asleep. And there was the time they left me with the old Gerald, good old Gerald, who taught me to strike a match, pinch the head in the book, cover, and yank. My gaze follows a slow-moving point across the expanse. I've got one for you, Dad. I stole this from Brian Swim. Don't look up, but imagine you're looking down at the stars. You actually are, you know. Gravity is keeping us here. That's interesting, John. I've never thought of it that way, looking down at the stars. I'm trying to get my mind to stay with that view. It's a little like looking at one of those pictures that looks jumbled until you suddenly see it. Wow, such beauty. Makes you wonder what the ancients thought of all this. You know, I just hope the human race gets its act together and becomes wiser. I often think the human race is at the adolescent stage. I think so too, Dad. That's the way good old Thomas Berry put it. He said, it's like the human species right now is autistic. I mean, so much changed when we dropped the bombs in Japan. Such power we have to destroy ourselves. What did Einstein say about the bomb Dad inhales? He was really against it. When it was dropped, he said, now everything has changed, except how we think. Oh, strong words. Yeah, we've got a long way to go, boy, before it moves towards wisdom. But I have hope. You have to look for the hope that's out there. There's people out there making a difference. That's true, there is, Dad. You teach me a lot. You teach me a lot too, John. You've read different things and have had different travels. Thanks, Dad. I admire you, Dad. Thanks, John. I'm going to take all this with me, this experience. It's nice to be here. You know, there was this guy I read about recently and I have to tell you about. He was confined to a wheelchair. He was confined, yet he ran a business. He had people doing things for him. All sorts of things. I read that he died recently. Anyway, this guy said one thing that I've tried to remember. He said, what was it now? I'm trying to live in the present and not give in to the thieves of the past or the thieves of the future. We take the cushions, cradle them under our arms, and hike up the little hill to the deck of the cottage, where we open the screen door. The Milky Way stretched, yes, it stretched, and the stars, they fell upon us. And inside the main room, with the log beams and the busted black piano all dark outside, voices hung in the summertime air. Guido's, Dad's, Terry's, the husbands of the three Lawrence sisters, everyone in their late 20s, early 30s. Me on the sofa, nodding off through the guys, going on for hours at the dining room table. Far out stuff. Astral traveling. Reincarnation. Zen. And the year, 1979, when out burst the film, Alien. The voices in the room. The child on the sofa. Drifting. That was Stars and Dad, a story I wrote. This concludes Life Rattle number 1300. My name is John Curry. Lori Callis recorded Alexander Geddes, Robert Jones, and myself reading their stories. Life Rattle was created by Arnie Ackman and Guy Allen. Be sure to tune in next time for a Life Rattle classic program hosted by Virginia Ashbury.